This is The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T.
Does it feel impossible to keep your kids from sitting in front of a screen all day? Coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you what you can do to manage their screen time effectively.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? For many of us, those words bring to mind the image of Fred Rogers in a sweater and sneakers broadcasting messages of kindness, acceptance, and empathy as part of Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. And those messages are just as important today. But Mr. Rogers was also involved in a larger conversation about race. He challenged the ideas of segregation, of injustice, and inequality, like, for example, in the famous pool scene where he washed his feet with Officer Clemens, played by Francois Clemens, the first African-American actor to have a recurring role on a children's television program. Well, Francois's book, Officer Clemens, a memoir, was recently released, and he joins us today to discuss his book, Mr. Rogers and His Role as Officer Clemens. Welcome, Francois.
I have always wanted to have a neighbor
just like you.
I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood
with you, so
let's make this most of a beautiful day.
Since we're together, we might as well say,
oh, would you be mine?
Could you be mine?
Won't you be
my neighbor? Hi, neighbor.
Hi, neighbor. How are you? Yeah. I love that you sang that. You have a nice tenor voice.
Well, thank you very much for recognizing that.
Yeah, not for rings, but you sing in a choir out there?
Oh, I don't sing in the big choir out here, but I do sing in a choir on occasion. I want to talk about Mr. Rogers. Tell me about the first time that you met Fred.
Well, I actually met him casually a couple of times. For example, I was a parasolos at Third Presbyterian Church, a pretty big, beautiful Presbyterian church on Fifth Avenue up there near Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. I was on my working on an MBA, a Master's of Essay, Fine Arts. And I got the job, and I was doing some singing, and I particularly did one on Good Friday. That's the time that Fred stayed till the end and was the last person to come up to greet me and say how much he enjoyed it and how much it meant to him because of its incredible significance. I don't know anybody else who does a program like that. Mm-hmm. And so he's a friend of a music major from Rollins College. So we really talk music. He's cutting edge in terms of being a composer and librettist. You know, he writes his own work. And also when he was here, he did a lot of the script music. What else do I want to say? Songs. He wrote songs. Lots of songs.
Uh-huh.
And so he composed them for special occasions. So I met him, and quite frankly, I thought he was a wonderful fan. I said, Fred, oh, that's your name. You're Joanne Rogers' husband. I knew his wife because she sang in the choir.
Uh-huh.
And we sat very close to each other. And we started talking, and afterwards we'd go out to a spaghetti place or some kind of a restaurant at night after choir rehearsal. And it was a wonderful group of people. They were like family among themselves, you know. They partied and picnicked and sang together and went to church as well as sang there in the choir. So I fell in with some really wonderful people and said, may I take you to lunch? And I thought, well, yeah, you know, I don't know you that well, but yes, take me to lunch.
Mm-hmm. And, I'll take a free lunch, you bet, yeah.
Yeah, you got it. I'm in graduate school, and graduate school is very expensive, even though I had essentially what you would call a free ride. There were lots of expenses that came about and what have you. So going out to dinner was not something I did very often. In fact, I ate at home, saved money. Then we went to this wonderful restaurant. And in fact, his wife and the organist came along. And they we had a drink around. Fred did not drink, so he had lemon water and maybe tonic water or something. And I was very skeptical about drinking in the middle of the day, but this was kind of exciting because there was my organist who had hired me and his wife who was one of my burgeoning new friends. And so they said, oh, we have to go. I made other plans for this afternoon, and frankly, it was a setup. and I didn't realize it, so that I could get comfortable, you know, and relax the spread and vice versa. Nothing crazy was going to happen. Well, as you can tell already, he sat there. I sat looking at him deep into his beautiful blue eyes, and I started talking. And I never shut up, and he never stopped listening. I thought, well, this is a relationship that's made in heaven.
Yeah.
Because he is a nice man who loves to hear me talk.
let me ask you this, Francois. Is this the time when he proposed that you be on the show? Because I'll be honest with you, I had no idea that you, in fact, were the first African-American actor to have a recurring role on a children's television program. I guess I had never thought about who that person would be, but that surprises me. That it was within the confines of you know, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and that was the very first.
Yeah. There have been guest appearances like Sammy Davis Jr., Diana Carroll had her own show, Julia. You know, there was some Sands, S-A-N-D-S. She was Diane Sands, was her name. She was a dynamic actress. Dorothy Dandridge, they all made guest appearances on. They were starting. Nina Horan, my goodness, she was such a star. But they did not appear on a children's television program with any regularity. And then when Fred hired me, like after I did two shows, and at the end of that, he said, "Would you like to come back and sing some more? We really like you." I mean, it was an incredible attraction, friendship. That I felt right away, this was very open, very warm, very gentle, very kind. In fact, I tell the story that soon after I met him, I got sick of the flu. And I went to get my doorbell, so my apartment rang. And I was thinking, who the heck is ringing my doorbell? You know, I'm sick. I don't feel like answering that damn thing. But I got up and I threw on a bathrobe and I staggered to the door. And I was, you know, you can look through a little peephole there. But, well, that's Fred. And I said, yeah, hi, Fred. What are you doing here? And he said, I heard you were sick. And he really marched right on past me and took off his coat, and he was carrying a bag of chicken soup, in fact, two containers. And he said, I want you to eat this right now. I'm going to sit with you and relax until you feel okay and everything. I was so weak. Well, I sat down. I thought, what is this man doing? He's taking care of me. There's a wonderful song. I'm taking care of you, taking good care of you. Well, once I was very little too. Now I take care of you.
Yeah, I love it.
Oh, thank you. And so he saved and practically fed me the food. He insisted that I eat it right away. I'm a strange eater. I can sit down and have a third of it or half of it, and I'm satisfied. I'll come back. Leave me alone. Don't touch my plate.
Yeah.
I'm coming back.
Yeah. Now leave it right there. I'll get to it.
Yeah, I do. But one of the reasons I do that is a lot of times I get called to come up and sing. Always to come up and sing. So I never really, really eat when I'm at those banquets and stuff. I'm already settled. I'm ready. So I'm sitting there picking and tearing on, and if it's something delicious, I want to come back. Get the red duck or some kind of special chicken. So anyway, we sat there easily 2 hours.
Wow.
He was asking me a lot of really good questions about my life, my growing up, my parents, my grandparents, and my great-grandparents. I thought, you know, he's really interested in what I have to say. So he said, why don't you come over to the station with me and let me show you around? And that was my first ever, I think, time being in a television studio. First time I was, like, before the cameras. I saw the set, you know, the Owl's Tree and the castle. It was fascinating, all this stuff going on in here. What was the purpose? And he was telling me, I had talked so much, but I hadn't asked him a thing. So he had said a word. He said, well, this is a children's project that I've been doing, I've worked on. And I put it together, and I'd like to have you come and sing something here. Well, I thought, yeah, okay. And then he got a suitcase, and he pulled out King Friday, and he started messing with those puppets. Well, Then he took Queen Sarah out and using her high voice. Hello there, Officer Simmons. How are you today? I thought, well, what in the world is the matter with this man? Just put that thing down and talk to me. Well, what I learned is that that was his aspects of his personality. And he had many different, basically calm and very much collected and pulled together. But I think sometimes he used the puppet to express when he had difficulty saying in words to adults. And he was shy. He definitely was an introvert and shy.
You know, so, I want to make sure that in the time that we have with you, and I don't have too much time left with you, we're visiting with Francois Clemens, Officer Clemens from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. A lot of people, just because of what's going on in the national and international climate, have probably seen or shared that pool scene with you and and Mr. Rogers. We have only really a couple minutes. Can you tell us, if people haven't seen what that is, what exactly that is, and then the value of it on the national and international conversation?
They were putting chemicals in the water pools in the middle of, like, Philadelphia or Nashville or Memphis. They all had these city pools. Of course, people who pay income taxes supported that kind of stuff. And they didn't want black people in those pools, and most of them are right dead in the center of town. And so the black people said, we're going anyway. And we went, and we got in the water and stuff. They started putting chemicals and powder of poison in that hurts your skin. I thought, to do that to people, do that to children.
Yeah.
You know, the children are the ones who basically were in the water playing, splashing. And these little kids, what the heck do they know? I really felt deep anger. So when I saw Fred, I let him have it. You know, what can you do about this, Fred? This is not a nice thing that these people are doing. Thank God I know people like you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he said, let me think about it, Fran. I think you I'm upset by it too, because it's hurting children, and Fred above all loved children.
Yeah.
So he came back to me a couple of weeks later and said, I have an idea. I want you to come to Pittsburgh. I lived in Manhattan at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to come to Pittsburgh, and I want you to do this special scene that will be addressing some of the race problems. So he sent me the script, and I looked at it, and I thought, well, what the heck is this? There's nothing going on.
Mm.
We sit at this pool. We sit in this pool together, and I sing a song. Come on, Fred, let's get an axe and a couple of 45s out here and then use it or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, friends, I think they'll get the message. So I bowed to his wisdom and his, better attitudes of how to reach his audience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we did that scene, and it became something very special. In the middle of it, I grew up. I changed because I said, oh, he's really showing a black man and a white man with their feet in the same water. It's borderline intimate in the sense that, you know, you could sit there with anybody you wanted to, but
right.
We were friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so our friendship made something special. It's a different chemistry of the warmth, the kindness, the generosity of spirit. He was so frankly loving to me. I felt this incredible cascade of wonderful positive feelings for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the same way about him, but I just didn't have the same way of expressing it. So he said a few things to me, and I sang a song. Who can crawl under a table? Who can bop? Who can? You see, I always remember the song, the tune, but I don't remember the words. They just put them up for me all the time.
Uh-huh.
So to make a long story short, we sat there together, and when I got ready, I said, I have an appointment. He helps me dry my feet, particularly in the second version we did in 1991 or two.
Mm-hmm.
We did a second one. And it was pronounced, it was rather prominent that he was doing that. There was no accident.
Right.
And so, biblically, people compared us to Jesus and Peter in the upper room during the Last Supper. And having done that Good Friday service with him, at Third Presbyterian Church, and he heard all that, he knew that I knew the religious significance, and I was a little bit of taken aback because I felt very unworthy. I felt I'm a deep believer in spirit, but I don't think you have to be a Christian necessarily to to get through this life. But he is a Presbyterian minister, so I know he was making reference to the fact that a black man and a white man could be good friends and sit with our feet in the water, and it was a sublime and incredibly uplifting thing that he did it. He had the charisma to add that element to what we were doing and make it something special. And especially when he started drying my feet, I was in on it. It was with his towel. And those, you don't mix. Adults rarely do share a towel with someone. Uh-huh. A husband and wife would do that. But I wouldn't share a towel with you. You know, generally, it was a very special effort, I think, to give me his towel and for him to dry my feet. So what I was reminded of, and I'll try to be brief, is just tell me, is, you know, in the Bible, there are many instances of the builder. And it characterizes either a great prophet, a great city, David, or God himself, herself. Takes the brick that was, the brick builder could not use because it was broken or was flawed. So he cast it aside. And God, the universe, goes and takes that brick and says, I'm going to build my church here. Hmm. And I'm starting with this brick. And I'm going to build a church that the very gates of hell shall not prevail against it.
Yeah.
I identified more with being that brick because I was black. I came from an extremely problematic background with parents fighting and poverty. Money was always an issue. And then the fact that I was gay and black. Black, gay, poor, and, you know, no money. I had no sense of the middle-class things that you would expect in this life.
Yeah.
And Fred had abundance. He was a millionaire. So he had everything that I was talking about in abundance. And he was so humble. He was so generous. He gave me so much. In the book, I try to share that with people. He was not into material possessions.
Yeah.
But he did understand that I didn't have it. Mm-hmm. And he took on the role of my father, and he became my surrogate father. And he told me, I'll be there for you, Francois. You don't have to worry about those things anymore. And it was hard to let those old habits go. But he was gentle, and he was firm. And there's so many things that I wish I could talk about now. But he just opened his heart to me, and I allowed him to be daddy. I have to tell you, I was so blessed that he came into my life.
We've been visiting with Francois Clemens. He is the author of Officer Clemens, a memoir, if you remember Officer Clemens from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. You can purchase that book by finding it at bookshop.org or books.catapult.co. Thanks for being with us, Francois. Coming up in 5 minutes, we'll find out what we can do to limit how much time our kids spend in front of screens each day.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Do you feel like disciplining your kids never works for you? In 20 minutes, we're going to give you some ideas about how you can do a little bit better at disciplining.
So the integration of technology in our lives, this is going to come as no shock, is on the rise. Not only is it hard to keep up with just ever-evolving tech, but it also seems impossible to manage our time on and off our devices. We're consumed by our phones, social media, music, TV, as we continually strive to be more productive and efficient. And we haven't even mentioned, you know, virtual learning and COVID and being socially distant. That is increasing our time.
Mm-hmm.
I know that a lot of people, businesses, companies, friends, family, are having these conversations right now. We wanted to you know, contribute to that conversation by giving you a little information that's going to help, knowing that our kids don't have as much self-control as adults, and really as adults being faced with how much self-control we thought we had versus how much we really have. Mm. So as parents, we often wonder if it's possible to manage screen time in a tech-driven world. Here to help us with that answer and question is Arlene Pelican, author and speaker, to help us understand how to help our kids navigate the tech-driven world as we're trying to navigate it. Welcome, Arlene. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you. I loved your morning buzz. That was really fun.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. We got to keep you informed.
Yeah. I hope you get a wolf t-shirt today.
Yeah. Tempting.
So, first to start this conversation, obviously with COVID, everything seems to be even more on screens.
Yes.
But I'd love to start this conversation with a little bit of perspective in really what it is that we're looking at. Do you think that we are worse off today when it comes to being consumed by technology than we were, say, 2 or 3 years ago?
I think for the average family, the answer would be yes. And here's how you want to look at it. You want to ask this question: is technology bringing my family closer together, or is it separating us? Mm-hmm. So in some families, technology can be very helpful. You can say, like, my goodness, we can Skype grandma, we can FaceTime our friends, we can be in touch with people overseas that maybe, you know, we're in the military. So all these different mm-hmm. things. But in the real life, you know, day to day, are you like, wow, I'm so glad my teenager has a phone. You know, I love it when my 8-year-old plays video games. That just is like awesome for his development. You know, so you just have to, let's get real. And how is it working? And really for parents to realize, okay, if I had a problem before COVID,
yeah.
then after COVID, this is going to be even so much harder, the habit, because, you know, is your child really spending 7 hours doing school exclusively, you know, or do they
right.
have 2 or 3 or 4 tabs open with all these things? What kind of habits are being built? And so as families, yes, we can leverage the technology to do school, to do the different things as we adapt. But we also have to kind of question it. Like, is this really all that it's cracked up to be? It's supposed to connect us and make us less stressed, make us happier. But you know that the statistics and your own life experience say, you know, when my daughter went on social media, she kind of fell into a hole, and that yeah. didn't work as well as I thought it would. So this is a great time. My youngest is in 6th grade.
Uh-huh.
She has 1/4 of online school behind her. And, you know, we have these points to reset, to kind of look and mm-hmm. say, is this working? And if this isn't working, what do I need to do? Maybe it's taking away a phone. Maybe it's after online school is over that it's like, hey, okay, after 7 p.m., we either watch a movie alone or we watch nothing. And we, like, you know, we're not all like staring at a screen when we've done that all day long already. So be encouraged that you can do things like that to help the situation.
I like that you put up points to reset, and I feel like every parent has to navigate that in their own way. For those
yeah.
who are struggling right now and want to know, I think that the overall feeling is just to sort of throw our hands up and give up and just to say, this is too hard. This is too overwhelming with a pandemic and Zoom school and screen times. We're just not going to worry about that right now. Why should we just worry a little bit?
Yes. Yeah. And there, I feel like, you know, instead of throwing those hands up, man, make a fist and say, hey, no more. You know, sometimes you just got to get angry enough to say, okay, my child has a childhood of 18 summers and I don't want them spending 10 years of that childhood behind a screen. You know, sometimes you just have to get kind of upset to say, you need to learn some real life skills and think about what needs to be done instead of the screens, whether it's, hey, you need to like be able to make your own lunch, to be able to do your own laundry. You need to be able to call an adult and talk to them. You need to like walk up to a customer service person in a store and ask a question. You know, like these are things you need to be able to do. And if we can't see that you're doing that, why are we giving you a phone and why are you on social media and video games? You're really great at that, but you're not good at the other things. And so part of it comes that, hey, my job is to equip you as a future adult and not just to entertain you through this time. And so I think the attitude comes first, like, wait a minute, there are some important things that we need to be doing. And then to realize it's going to be hard at first, but then later it's much easier. So let's say at first it's hard to give up the video games. First it's hard to give up the social media. First it's hard to say, hey, YouTube for only half an hour today. Mm-hmm. But then later when you see your child and they're playing with Legos and they're playing outside and they're reading books, you're going to be like, why did we not do this sooner? This is so much, this is a better environment for our kids, better for us. So a couple warning signs that your kid is getting too much screen time. You might see that they're irritable, they're depressed, they're angry, they have a hard time focusing at school, they're disorganized, they're sneaking around trying to get more screen time. Mm-hmm. They're only happy when they're on their screen. They forfeit other activities that they used to like, you know, because they'd rather be on a screen. So, you know, they can't go a few days without any video games. So you see these kinds of things happening, and then you realize, okay, wait a minute, I think this is getting a little out of control.
We're talking with Arlene Pelican about tech screen time with our kids. One of the things that is an unavoidable thing is that so many students are having to be behind a screen for the school to be able to get their virtual learning, whatever that looks like, depending on where individuals live and how they're engaging. And so we can't, where in the past we would have probably said, well, no screen time.
Right. Right. Yes.
They have to be able to engage in it. So are there different ways within the time that they are engaging in learning? You mentioned other tabs that they would have open and are engaging in social media and those things that way. Are there ways that we can limit what they're able to do while they're doing their school time, or other considerations that will help them to be focused and use that screen time appropriately?
Yes. So if you're able to be with your child for a little bit, you know, if your job is okay, that you could say, hey, for the first hour, like for a reset period, right? Mm-hmm. So for that first hour, I'm going to sit there. I'm going to look. Now you're going to wonder, okay, then when I'm gone, what's going to happen?
Sure. Right.
But at least you're showing, teaching, hey, let me see. And then it kind of gives you this shared experience with your child. Like, oh, this is really boring. Like, you have a shared experience.
I know.
With your child. But Whew. You can also coach them. Like, hey, when you're at work, you have in the future, when you're an adult, you'll also have this temptation, like to be shopping and watching scores, baseball scores or whatever, you know, yeah. Like teach them that this is going to be part of life, but you've got to focus because we want you to get ahead in life. And so, you know, just modeling how you do it for your work. And that means we have to straighten up. That's one way to do it, by sitting next to your child mm-hmm. and coaching them. That's another way to do it, by actually taking away any other device and putting it under lock and key during school time, except the device that's for school. Mm. And you say, oh, but I need my phone. No, you really don't. Like, yeah. You can survive on just your Chromebook or your laptop or whatever you're looking at. So things like that will help. And then telling your child, okay, then we're just doing homework. But then, you know, it's not going to be Netflix. It's not going to be YouTube. It's not going to be these things. And maybe it means that you unsubscribe to certain streaming services. You know, that's what a novel idea.
Wait a minute.
I know. For like a month to kind of check this out and to see how you're doing. So to help them out as much as possible.
We talk about screen time like they're all created equal. Are there certain screens that are worse than others?
Yes, they are not created equal. And so you've got to think of them as digital vegetables and digital candy. And a vegetable, there's things like, hey, I'm Skyping grandma. I'm learning my times tables. I'm watching a church service online because we didn't get to go. Those are digital vegetables. They're going to make your kids stronger. And they're not the thing that you see your kid doing at 2 a.m. In the morning. You know, mm-hmm. oh, look at that. You're doing your math. Isn't that cute? You know,
I caught you zooming with grandma again.
Yes,
get off the screen. Yeah.
Again.
If you zoom with grandma. One more time.
You're going to hear it. So, you know, and then the digital candy is, of course, YouTube videos, Netflix, you know, the dark places of the internet, the cute things, but they're just meaningless, you know, all that stuff. And so a little bit of candy, not the dark stuff, but a little bit of fluff, you know, is okay. But fluff all day long, just like having candy all day long, is not good. So, of course, video games are going to be more addictive. YouTube, social media, that is all designed to keep your child online. Netflix, the CEO said his biggest competitor was sleep. You know, so these kinds of things to understand, these are very addictive technologies versus others that are not so much. And of course, the more mobile it is, the more dangerous, because it's just in your child's pocket. You know, it's like giving your child a bag of M&Ms and putting it in their pocket and saying, hey, good luck with that. You know, they're going to open it and they're going to eat that all day long.
Yeah.
And
I know that candy will be delicious.
Yeah.
I know that candy will be delicious, but just keep it in your pocket. Don't eat it.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting thing, especially when I hear other people say it, when you talk about like that Netflix, the biggest competition is sleep, and that we know that from the literal colors to the notifications on social media, that they are intended to be addictive. And yet we all go, oh, yeah, no, we'll do that. Yeah, we'll engage. Mm-hmm. We're going to go ahead and use that service. And then we come on the side of it and go, wait, how come we got addicted? And it's like, no, that was what they intended. That's what we allowed them into our lives to be able to do.
Yes, very wise what you're saying. And so you can imagine as an adult, if we're like, okay, we're okay with that. Imagine for a child, they're not going to be like, oh, this is not good for my brain. You've hijacked my attention. You know,
right.
Be able to do that. So you as a parent have to be the big meanie and say, okay, you know, I've got two high schoolers and a sixth grader, no social media, no personal cell phone, no personal iPad. But we have a lot of tech at home. It just doesn't go with them.
So I think I would like to take and kind of to end our conversation with looking at it as a larger issue, because with this conversation, we're talking about what we want to teach our kids and what messages we really want to get in there. So what life skills do you think that parents should be focusing on when we have these discussions with our kids in this tech-driven world?
I think a big, huge thing is reading, for a child to be able to sit, to have sustained attention, to read a book, to think for themselves. Because think, if you're raised on this quick, fast-paced, you know, technology on your phone, video games, et cetera, your brain just gets used to these very small interactions and you don't go very deep. And so as they get older, I really believe they're going to be very easily manipulated, because they just look at social media, they look at YouTube. What am I supposed to think? What am I supposed to do? Okay, I guess that's what everyone does. That seems good and that feels good to me. Let's do that. You know, so I think that is a huge thing, of letting kids think, of challenging them to do that, and reading and not being online. That's a great way to do that. And then personal skills, right? Mm-hmm. Looking someone in the eye. All the stuff that you and I would do naturally for 10, you know, a generation ago.
Uh-huh.
But today, if a child, 10 years old, looks you in the eye, nice to meet you, Miss Lisa. What's it like being on the radio? And you'd be like, oh, who is this child that can like talk to me and look at me? And, you know, so interpersonal skills, so important. And the idea that the person comes first and the device comes second, teaching a child, hey, you pivot away from your device and you look at someone when they come home instead of just being hunched over and, you know, you never move. So all those things are so important. And even physically, you just think of it from head to toe, from eyesight to obesity, all those things that are challenged by that sedentary screen time, that we've just got to switch that up.
Yeah, so important to have these conversations.
Arlene, before we let you go, you do a podcast, the Happy Home Podcast. Is it this kind of stuff that you talk about?
Absolutely. So Happy Home Podcast. And then I'm interviewing people, marriage people, parenting people, helping them. I'm going to have a nurse, Melanie Hempe, that's on about the Screen Strong Challenge, which is a 7-day detox. So yes, it's the Happy Home Podcast.
Awesome. And if people want to get more information about Arlene, they can go to arlenepelicane.com.
Coming up, we're going to learn new parenting strategies to help our kids learn from their mistakes.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You know, I love to talk about controversy. And one controversial subject in parenting is timeouts, whether they're effective or not, how to use them, how not to, whether to follow through or not, how to follow through. Timeouts are just a stressful situation.
Now, I know we're going to talk about this with kids, but before we get into this for children, I want to take 10 seconds. Do you ever put yourself in a timeout away from your children?
I was just going to bring that up, actually. Mm-hmm. That's so funny because I realized that when I was so worked up that, you know, here are kids are just, they're trying to learn how to emotionally regulate, right? Mm-hmm. Like, especially when they're little and they don't know what's going on and they're overstimulated or they're so confused. It's us as adults that need to calm down. Yeah. And I have put myself in, I have become so frustrated in situations, you know, things piling up or whatever. I can't even think of a specific example because it doesn't matter, where I will say to the kids, I'm not ready to talk about this right now. I'm just going to go in my room for just a minute. And I will.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. It's not the worst thing in the world.
No. I've gone so far as to say, I am going to go put myself in a mm-hmm. timeout. Normally, it consists of a nap of some sort, but I'll just be like,
if you're overtired.
I just need a timeout. And then I just sort of disappear. Yeah. And then I come back out and go, okay, now what?
And I think that's the intended, I was going to say, kind of art form, really, of the timeout, right? You just want everyone to, not just the kid, to take a deep breath. But when kids are little and their like scream is so piercing, or the timeout expresses itself in the entire body, it can be it is just a frustrating situation, and it's hard in that moment to know what to do. So we thought it would be worth the time to really have a conversation about, okay, so when we're stepping out, we're not in the middle of it right now. What's the right way to do it? Is it the right way to call it a timeout? Is it just a deep breath? What is effective about it? And how, you know, research and parenting techniques change over time. So what have we found to really be the most effective way to teach emotional regulation, which is what we're all looking for? So here to discuss with us these pros and cons of timeouts, how to use them more effectively, is Dr. Lucy McGoran, parenting strategist, researcher, and assistant professor at the Merrill Palmer Skillman Institute. Welcome.
Hello, good morning.
Okay, so I think that we all have examples, and I want to start this conversation of how timeouts have gone wrong, right? We all have that cautionary tale. What do people, have you felt, often get wrong when they're using timeouts?
Sure. I think part of the problem is that when we talk about timeout, people aren't always talking about the same thing. Hmm. So I think a lot of people imagine a parent yelling, go to your room, and that's a timeout.
Oh.
Whereas mental health professionals like myself, we talk about a very specific procedure with specific steps when we talk about a timeout.
So then walk us through the very specific steps and procedure of a timeout so we can all be on the same page.
Sure. So a timeout should start with a parent giving a brief explanation, like, you hit your brother, you're getting a timeout.
Mm-hmm.
And then walking the child quietly, calmly to a designated timeout spot. And I recommend using an adult-sized chair in a kind of calm, kind of low-traffic, quiet area. And then the next step is a parent sitting the child down in the chair, telling them, you're going to stay here until I tell you to get up. And then staying close by but walking away so the child has some space to calm down. And then having the child sit for a very brief amount of time. This is also something that people can get wrong, where they think longer is better for timeouts. But there's really no evidence for that, and it can backfire if a parent tries to make the timeout too long. Hmm. So a timeout should be very brief, just a few minutes. A good rule of thumb is to have a child sit for 1 minute for each year old they are. So a 4-year-old would sit for 4 minutes.
And it's easy to remember.
That seems about in line with me, because I need just as many minutes as years old I am just to get that break. I mean, that's
true.
That's a perfect amount.
And then it's really important that the parent is the one that says that the timeout is over. So they officially announce, you've done your timeout, you can go back to playing or doing whatever now. So those are the five steps. I would also add that after that, it's really important that parents take a minute to reconnect with their child, that they look for the positive behaviors that their child are doing, take a minute to play or read a book, something to reconnect after this stressful timeout period.
And so what is it about a timeout that affects the children's behavior? How does it affect it?
I think what you were saying before is really important, that it's a strategy that we learn that when we get overwhelmed, when we kind of lose control of our behavior, we need to step back, take a moment, have quiet. I think just having some moments of quiet is so important. And all of that contributes to a child learning emotion regulation abilities.
Are there some children for whom, like, for that timeouts aren't effective or not, you know, appropriate?
Sure. In terms of how long they sit in the chair, you know, some children mm-hmm. just will absolutely not do that. You know, I think that that doesn't come as a surprise that some children will just get up mm-hmm. over and over again. I recommend a general strategy where parents take their children back to the chair, kind of starting the timeout over, explaining again that they're going to sit. But for some children, it just might not work. You know, they might just be kind of so dysregulated that they keep getting out of the chair over and over again.
Hmm. Is there the issue on the other side of it? Because I would imagine that there are some kids that are like, fine, I'll sit in this chair.
Oh,
I'll
yeah.
just go ahead and I'll just,
one
be,
of those.
I'll just be in this chair and
yeah,
that's
I
fine.
I can sit here all day.
You promise no one's going to bother me here? This chair is a pretty good situation.
Yes, I actually have a four-year-old who's a lot like that.
Oh.
And so for you know, parents need a lot of different parenting tools, and
yeah.
I might not be the best tool for every child.
Yeah. So let's talk about the situations in which it's appropriate to use a timeout. I mean, I think there's the assumption if you use it too often that it might lose its effectiveness. If you use it too infrequently, they don't know what's happening. When should you use timeouts?
Yeah, you definitely don't. It's not something you want to use too often. You don't want to be putting a child in timeout every day. It takes a lot of time and effort for parents to do this procedure correctly. Mm-hmm. So you want to reserve using a timeout for the most challenging child behaviors. The biggest one to me is aggression, you know, hitting, kicking, pinching, those kinds of things mm-hmm. Would warrant a timeout. But don't use it for really minor behaviors like whining or complaining or talking back. Those mm-hmm. kinds of things can just be ignored or you know, redirected more easily.
We're talking with Dr. Lucy McGoran about timeouts, when to use them, how to use them effectively. Do you think that we, as a society, as a culture, have misused timeouts and so that they've lost their effectiveness? Or do you think that we're getting better at using them?
I think it depends on how they're used and how that term is used. You know, if they're used these really specific steps, there's mm-hmm. lots of research to show that they're effective, that they're not harmful, that they can really reduce children's challenging behavior.
Why is it so hotly contested between those who would think that it's appropriate and those who would say, don't do this?
I think a big part of that is that, you know, people have different children that are very different. What I've often hear with people don't like timeout is they say, that's just not necessary, that mm-hmm. oh, you can just tell a young child no, you can just redirect them. But they might have more easygoing children. Some children are a lot more strong-willed. They need a lot firmer limit set. So those differences in children can lead to differences of opinion.
Is there a sort of an age range that sort of loses the efficacy of timeouts?
Yeah, as children get older, it's going to be less effective and less needed. I generally recommend it is a good strategy for children ages 2 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it could differ by the child. It might, for some 6 or 7 year olds, it might still be worthwhile. I don't recommend it for children under 2. They're not going to stay put.
Yeah.
They're not going to understand what's going on.
What about for adults? Lisa's really kind of just asking around it. Like when her and I get into it a little bit, we don't know who's supposed to put the other in a timeout, and we that to be able to get that, something like that to work. But there is an element, joking aside, there is an element to each of us to know our own emotional welfare and to remove ourselves from it. But is that altogether that different from what we're helping our kids discover?
I think we're teaching them the skill that we all use as adults, that when we get overwhelmed, taking a moment of quiet can be really helpful.
Yeah. When you're over, either like stimulated or you're over stressed out, and those kind of intense feelings, if you're experiencing them, it seems to me that that's not the time to discipline your kid or to talk to your kid. Have you ever found yourself in a situation like that?
Absolutely. And I think that's an important point, that if a parent is so upset in the moment that doing time out with their child probably isn't a good idea. It's a better idea for them to give themselves a moment before they come back to worrying about discipline.
Is there a good check? I mean, we've sort of gone over the steps or whatever, but I think that in the moment we would be very quick to forget all of those things. Do you have a way, whether it's a mnemonic device or some sort of acronym or something, that gives us the skill to go, okay, I am feeling this, I want to make sure that I execute this timeout, on points rather than on emotion, and be able to do this the right way?
I think planning ahead of time is really important. You know, even in my house, I have written down the steps of time out and taped on the inside of a closet door.
That's smart.
Also, that's so smart.
I think it's important to talk to children before you even try to do a timeout to go over these steps, because nobody holds you accountable more like young children. You know, they'll say, right? No, that's not what you were supposed to do. So you can go over these steps with them, tell them what kind of behaviors are going to lead to a timeout, what's going to happen, where is it going to be, so that you're all on the same page.
Is it difficult for you as a researcher, as a professional with this, to see timeouts used in practice in other settings with, say, friends or family and not say anything?
Yes, that definitely is. I've seen people say timeout in a variety of settings, and it's like, oh, that's not how I would do it.
Yeah, that must be difficult.
I try to bite my tongue in those situations unless people specifically ask.
You've got good manners. I appreciate that.
I would love it if you're like, listen, Dr. Lucy here. Let's talk about the structure of what you've just done.
And
insert yourself into any possible situation. Oh, I feel like you earned it. You might as well share it with everybody.
And we're going to give you the opportunity right now here. Okay.
Oh.
So you've seen a lot. You've researched a lot. What do you wish every parent knew about timeouts that maybe they don't?
I wish they knew these steps, and I wish they knew that timeout can be a way to model being calm, you know, staying calm in difficult situations. So a lot of the things that I read about timeout in the media make it seem like this very harsh parenting strategy where the parent is mad and they're kind of setting this really kind of mean limit. I wish people knew that it could be done in this gentler way that actually teaches children how to take a moment, how to calm down, how to quiet down. And so it can be really effective in that way.
I'd like to end where we began. Can you give those steps again? Give that opportunity for us to write those down and really make sure that we have them?
Sure. So the first one is the parent should give a brief explanation about why the child is going to timeout. Then quietly walk the child to timeout. Sometimes the parent might have to pick the child up. I recommend doing so kind of in a gentle way from the back underneath the arms. Then the parent should put the child in the timeout chair, giving them an explanation that they're going to stay there until it's time to get up. And then have the child sit for a brief amount of time. 1 minute for each year old they are is a good rule of thumb. And then the parent should stay quiet until it's time for the timeout to end. And they should tell the child that the timeout is over. And then what I think is really important is to have a moment of reconnecting with the child at the end.
Yeah. Important steps, and we appreciate you sharing them with us. Dr. Lucy McGoran, parenting strategies researcher and assistant professor at the Merrill Palmer Skillman Institute. For more information on Dr. McGoran's research into parenting strategies, you can visit her page at Wayne State University.
It's a great discussion. You know, I think it's such a funny thing that when you're kid has a tantrum, especially like in public. Parents typically, myself included, like have felt embarrassed and feel like that they need to sort of explain it to people around. And I think that the more that we have discussions like this and keep it open, we all know, oh no, yeah, we've experienced this. It's fine. And don't put that added pressure on parents, especially in public, to quote unquote, like perform the way to do it. Well, they weren't, you know, strict enough, or they were too lenient, or they, you know, whatever the criticism may be, being able to really like take care of the kid is the most important.
I love that she gave, you know, as parents, we always make the joke, like, parenting didn't come with an instruction manual, right? Like, anybody see the directions for this kid? Yeah. But those were very easy steps, right? That if I if I have them written down, or, you know, I listen to this again and
she's
again
an expert
by
she's
subscribing
already got
to
it.
The Lisa Show podcast, whatever, you know, my means for having that is, I can go. Now, what do I do next? Yeah. All right. I put them, you know, a minute for each year. Okay. That's doable.
Even Dr. McGoran has them written down in her house.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was very encouraging.
Yeah.
Hop on over to the Lisa Show at BYU.edu for a chance to make a connection. This is, you know, we want to be a little bit vulnerable and just say we are very social people that work in radio. And so a lot of times we have to imagine the people that we're talking to. We love to talk to people and make those real connections. And one way that we do that is by reading your emails and talking about back and forth about what you like about the show or ideas that you have or an insight into your life and how it is affected by the sort of conversations that we have. I know it's a big ask, or it seems like a big ask, but the Lisa Show at BYU.edu is a great way for us to make a real connection.
I don't know that I would have a friend named Merlene. I'm just going to speak it into the universe right now.
Name.
You know, because of this show, because of someone who emailed in, we are friends with a woman named Merlene.
Yeah.
We would not be friends. Let me speak only for me. I don't know that I have ever met a Merlene otherwise.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure that I would ever have a friend named Merlene, especially one as special as the Merlene that we have met, without the email that we have asked you guys to send. TheLisaShow@BYU.edu. Now it's like we're friends. It's like I come in, I go, has Merlene emailed me? Yes, she has. What are we talking about? And I'll be honest, sometimes I go, I don't even know what we're talking about. And then I have to remember, oh yeah, we talked about that yesterday on the show.
Yeah.
It's TheLisaShow@BYU.edu. Whether it's a connection that, you know, builds a Merlene friendship of a lifetime, or you just like to say, hey, you know what? I really appreciated when you guys spoke to parenting teenagers. That's something that I'm really struggling with. Or, you know, meal prepping has been something that I've always wanted to do but haven't understood the financial piece of it. Thank you for talking about that. We love hearing from any and everyone about that. It's TheLisaShow@BYU.edu.
Coming up in about 6 minutes, we'll help you put together a family Christmas card on a tight budget.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You're listening to Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. It's The Lisa Show.
Do you beat yourself up when you make a simple mistake? Coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to find out how to be more forgiving of ourselves when things don't go the way we want them to. Okay, so you've decided this year is the year. You've been putting it off for a while now, but you're holding steadfast to your decision to make it happen. This is the year that you're going to finally send out a holiday card. Now, why have you been dragging your feet on it? Well, we know. Come on. Family photos. It's tough. It is rough. It requires a lot of patience and steadfastness and stick-to-itiveness. right? It is the bane of impatient parents everywhere. Okay, so one kid's always cold. One kid is tired of smiling and just doesn't feel it, right? And they, or one kid, usually a toddler, just wants to make their body go limp so you can't do anything. And you get that sort of crazy tinge in your voice of, hey, what would you like? Oh, I promise we'll go get ice cream after whatever. And you can hear the nervous laughter in your expression when you're bribing because you don't want to seem like you've lost it and what you really want to say to your kid. But because you don't want to make them, you know, cry or feel intimidated, because we're showing everyone in this picture how much fun we're having as a family, right? But listen, why do we do these kinds of things? Because so we can look back on them and we have the memory. We know that they grow up so fast. We want to have a picture that freezes our family in sort of a time and place. Well, fortunately for all of us who are struggling with family photos, especially around this time of the year, we've got friend of the show, Carrie Ann Rhodes, here to help us. Today, we're talking all things family photos and how to make it as seamless and fun. Yes, fun as possible. Welcome, Carrie Ann.
Good morning, Lisa. We're going to do it this year.
Yeah, we're going to do it. Now, we are just going to dive right into it. First of all,
okay.
Is this something that you're doing? Do you think that a lot of families are taking this year, this COVID year off, or are we still doing it?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I can see both reasons why people would or would not, but I'm kind of anticipating that because this year we have not seen each other as much.
Mm-hmm.
We may not have, taken that trip to visit that friend or that family member or whatever this year, that people might do a card who don't usually do cards to show, hey, we're okay.
Look how much we've grown this last year. Like, we haven't seen you forever.
A holiday card is a way to connect over the holidays without having to make the phone calls or do gifts. But I love holiday cards because it just shows me,
I know,
oh, here's my friend and here's their family this year. And I love hanging cards up and seeing their faces and just kind of knowing, like, oh, the world is a good place because this person is in it. So I'm one that appreciates holiday cards, but I don't do them every year because sometimes we don't have time. We don't prioritize it. So that's why we're talking about it now on the 2nd of November to make sure we give plenty of time to think about these things, kind of plan ahead, give you some strategies for success.
I love it. Well, let's get right to those strategies because I feel like one of the major sort of bumps in that prevent me from doing this is I think, well, should I just have my phone on a timer? Should I hire a photographer? Like, then that's another phone call and an appointment. Like, and as silly as it sounds, it can be a major a deterrent for a lot of people. What sort of deciding factor do you use in trying to decide if you're going to hire a photographer or not?
We have done family portraits all sorts of ways.
Mm-hmm.
We have hired photographers, which is terrific. We have used pictures that I think last year we just used pictures from my camera roll. That maybe or maybe not. I don't even remember if I needed to even put a filter on them because I remember one was like so lush and green. It was beautiful. That's why we took a picture right there. Or I've had family pictures taken where a family member did it for us, or even just using an iPhone. These days, our handheld devices have such excellent cameras on them.
Mm-hmm.
Way better than any previous kind of handheld camera. And so, depending on your budget or the time that you have, you've really got a lot of options. One of my favorite things to do that's easy for kids is in our area, we've got these photo studios that have several different, it's like a big, open kind of, not a warehouse, but like a space. It has several different backdrops. And you just show up and you pay a basic fee, which is usually around $100, which is very inexpensive for hiring a professional photographer. And you go and you get several background choices. You get lots of kind of working with the photographer of, do you want to stand up? Do you want to sit down? Do you want to, you know, let your kids twirl, you know, whatever. And so that's been a good kind of low key option rather than hiring one person and going somewhere. There's so many options.
There's so many options. And I will say too, that just a plug for professional photographers, if you are in a position and that's not a concern, hiring someone, especially now when a lot of events are canceled, would be a great way to support a local business or a local family who are artists. And you're not just getting the camera with the photographer, but you are getting a sort of a different perspective on the art form. I know, at least for me, when because I've done, like you, both. Hey, we'll just do it ourselves, or use a family member, and then use a professional. And the professional always gets these unexpected sort of gems of photos that have become my favorites over the years.
Absolutely, and especially if you're looking for like a portrait, you can't be a professional. And in this year, exactly what you said, where so many important events have been canceled. Do you know a photographer that you can support this year? And, you know, help them grow their business, and you will get what you pay for with a professional photographer. You'll get technical know-how. You'll get beautiful pictures. So
yeah. So as you're trying to kind of make that decision, keep all of those things in mind.
Right.
So
as you're planning,
Go on.
As you're planning, one thing that I never thought of before.
Okay. Go on.
Choose the card before you choose the picture.
I don't think I've ever thought of that.
No, and I spend like not hours, but lots and lots of minutes going through the different, you know, sites that do holiday cards, and like I've got this picture now, and I love this card, but it doesn't fit the format. Or I wish I had left room on this photo so that the words could be over the photo. Like all these little tiny details that you're sifting through hundreds of templates. Why not go choose a template you like first, and then make sure that your photo is landscape, or that it's portrait, or that you leave the room for having the words above your head. I thought that was like the best advice ever, rather than
that is groundbreaking.
Making it fit what you've got.
I have never thought of that. Actually plan it out ahead of time. Wait,
right.
What? Now, if I see one more harried mom at Target or Old Navy or Gap or something like that with bags of like sweaters and shirts trying to coordinate family photos,
right,
I might lose it. I mean, it's you talk to any parent who's parented for more than, I don't know, 6 months, and this is something we all have in common. It brings us together. What are we going to wear? Are we doing primary colors? Are we picking two colors, three colors? Is there a science to choosing the outfits for family photos? That is my question.
Yes. Science is called don't worry so much about it.
I like that. Is that a technical term? Okay, cool.
It's technical. I think it's Latin.
Great, great.
Even if you're going through, you know, those lots of minutes of looking at holiday templates, it's actually a good, if you look at the, you know, the models, the stock photos that they're using of the people in those templates, they look fantastic in those photos. They're not matchy-matchy.
Yeah.
And they're barely maybe even coordinated. So definitely coordinate, but do not match. That's kind of out. I know some people have even like, well, my decor is this, so we're going to kind of like wear this, and it's unnecessary. It's unnecessary in a portrait. So make sure that you're comfortable. Try to go for no hats, no graphics or pictures on your t-shirts. I've seen some hilarious photo fails where only a part of a word shows up in the photo, and it, you know, can be awkward. No small patterns, like small checks, small flowers, houndstooth don't translate well in the picture. And maybe try to stay away from being too contrasty of just like black and white, unless you're going for something like really stylized or kind of interesting. But just remember to pick your battles. So if you've got a child who is going through their goth phase right now, work it into the photo.
Really? Make it, don't fight it.
Make it. Don't fight it. Just make it a part of this is our family and this is how we are.
We're talking with Carrie Ann Rhodes about family photos, about this time of year when we, you know, kind of the do's and don'ts and how to make it a better process. Okay, so I just want to summarize what you just said so that we can get it. You don't have to match. First of all, just think of comfort, no hats, graphics, or pictures, no small patterns, but then everything else is on the table. Are there colors that we should stay away from?
No, I would say I've seen darling photos of families in all kind of, you know, situations. But some of my favorites are where the family members are wearing something that reflects their personality. And I think that's cute. I think that's nice. I don't care if all the girls are wearing red and the boys are wearing blue. And, you know, that to me is a little too contrived. I like photos that seem more natural and bring out the fun personalities of your family.
Okay, so I did this last year, and I just said, everyone was like, well, family photos, because they hate when I tell them what to wear. So I was like, just wear whatever you want. I just want it to, like, photos in our home wearing whatever. Well, my husband and I were laughing so hard because it just shows how casual my kids are. But I will say that the photos do make me laugh. We were not coordinated at all. It was very, very casual. And I was glad that the year previous we had dressed up. You know right. What I mean? Like, I do like sort of Sunday best. So, you know, maybe that's my voice for just, you know, maybe every other year. Let them choose.
Every other year. Well, if your kids don't mind, because I prefer, you know, us in kind of like our Sunday best, nicer clothing as well. And if it's not going to cause fights, or if that's not the hassle, like, pick your battles in this. If you can get away with that, do it.
Yeah.
If it's going to be a huge argument and like fighting all day and whatever, then leave it to the side. I've got some good day of practices to help us make that kind of day of the photo.
Hit us.
Easy. Someone mentioned in here ice cream, getting ice cream after. Was that you?
Yeah, that was me.
I say get the ice cream first.
Really? Okay. Oh, put them in a good mood right from the get-go.
Put them in a good mood from the get-go. Let's go and get ice cream. Just make sure that you bring some, like, wipies with you to make sure faces are clean, or, you know your kids. But eat beforehand. Make sure that you have full stomachs. Don't wait for that food bribe. Or after, you've got to have good blood sugar. You need some, you know, good energy. Spend 5 minutes before you go into the photographer just playing. Just, you know, running around outside, doing a little bit of fun, something. If you're bringing a pet into the photo shoot, make sure that pet has a little bit of energy taken out, as well as the four-year-old, get the energy out a little bit. That way you get kind of the wiggles and the giggles and the like, excitement of it. Just expend that energy a tiniest bit, so that by the time you get in there, you're calm. Bribe freely, you know, afterwards, we're going to do this, or, you know, you get this, but, you know, don't be afraid of the bribe. And then a couple of issues, if you're doing a photo by yourself, make without a photographer or a professional photographer, make sure the family is viewed straight on, not like in a line where, like, one person is, you know, 5 feet away from the camera, and then another person is like 6 feet, 7 feet, 8 feet away from the camera.
Okay, so the composition of it, like,
composition,
think
you
about
want
it
straight on, or else someone's going to look giant and someone's going to look small, right?
Sure, yeah.
And then,
like an illusion.
it can be an unintentional illusion. Make sure that the photo is being taken at the eye height of the subject. So if you and your family are sitting down, then the camera should be a little lower at your eye level. Or if you're standing, make sure it's at eye level. And then make sure that you are cropping appropriately. Like, don't cut off any heads, you know, at the top of the head. You can always kind of crop in later, but you can't crop out. So keep that in mind if you're taking that photo.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we only have about less than a minute left. Last tips to make this year's family photo the very best one.
make it a good time. It, if a family photo is, or if you're suggesting it and everyone's like,
yeah,
how can you reframe this? But this is going to be like a fun family moment for you. What can you do to kind of make everyone involved, even the kids, to get them on board with what's going to happen and have it be a fun experience? And it will be reflected for sure in your lovely family portrait this year.
I love it. We want that feeling of family and home and what your family represents to be in that. Thank you for taking your time to walk us through that, Carrie Ann. It's always a pleasure.
Sure.
Carrie Ann Rhodes is a friend of the show who specializes in making happiness, comfort, and love align in the home. You can follow her at Twitter at Carrie Ann Rhodes. So fun just to think about all of the things that we are sort of pivoting in this holiday season. It's nice to know that some things can stay the same, and family photos, like, this is my big pitch of, like, make sure you capture the moment. This is a year that we're going to remember, so you might as well have a nice photo of it, right?
Coming up in 6 minutes, we'll learn how to be kinder to everyone, especially ourselves.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Are you exercising as much as you like? In 20 minutes, we're going to find out just how much exercise is too much.
Now, I usually find it pretty easy to give someone else the benefit of the doubt. You know, I don't really hold grudges, but when it comes to myself, I am really hard on myself. I'm a very harsh critic. And I think a lot of people feel the same way. You know, going easy on someone else or giving them a lot of compassion,
a little bit of grace,
leeway and grace seems very easy, but on ourselves, because I think sometimes we're not always super conscious of it, is another thing, especially during such anxiety inducing times. I think it's about time that we start practicing a little bit more self-compassion. So how do you practice it? How do you exercise that muscle? Well, here to talk us through it is Kristen Neff, author and pioneer of self-compassion research. Thanks for joining us, Kristen.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I'm happy to be here.
I'd love for us to all be on the same page for this kind of conversation. When we talk about self-compassionate, what does that mean? What does it look like?
Right. Okay. So a lot of people think it just means going easy on yourself. And sometimes it does mean going easy on yourself. And it certainly means not harshly criticizing or beating yourself up. But compassion is really concerned with the alleviation of suffering. So when you give yourself compassion, you actually say, well, what do I need right now that will help me? And sometimes that means going easy on yourself. Sometimes it actually might mean encouraging yourself to make a change or maybe even a little tough love, right? So the idea is just as you care about your friends and you want them to be well and you help them and you support them, we just turn that around so that we also adopt that attitude toward ourselves.
I really like that, alleviating suffering. That's what it is.
Right.
We don't necessarily like hear that a lot, I think. That's kind of a new way to look at it. For those who are thinking, well, it doesn't matter. You know, I'm benefiting from the way that things are. I don't even need to examine it. What are some of those benefits of practicing self-compassion?
Well, the benefits are tremendous. First of all, the number one reason people criticize themselves harshly is that they think it's going to motivate themselves to change and do better and reach their goals. The research shows it's the exact opposite. In other words, being encouraging and supportive towards yourself, just like perhaps a really good coach might be, an athletic coach, actually enables you to reach your goals more easily than harshly criticizing yourself. I mean, you know, let's face it, shame isn't exactly a get-up-and-go mindset, right?
Yeah, sure.
So when we're feeling shame, when we undermine our self-confidence, when we call ourselves names, what it actually does is create a lot of performance anxiety. You know, stakes are so high whether or not we succeed that it actually undermines our ability to reach our goals. So self-compassion, again, it doesn't necessarily mean going easy on yourself. Maybe it's saying, you can do it. I believe in you. I'm here for you. I'm going to support you. But listen, you really got to try harder because this isn't working out for you, right? And that type of supportive approach actually is much more effective. It's linked to less fear of failure, And then in just in terms of mental health, the benefits are huge. Less anxiety, less depression, less stress, more happiness, greater life satisfaction, optimism. So it's like the superpower we have in our own back pocket, the power to support ourselves when needed. And we don't even know it's there.
But, you know, I listen to all this and I think, Kristen, yeah, but I should. We have had this conversation or similar conversations here on the show before. And we should ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. We should. I shouldn't. We place all of this stuff inwardly. How do we get out of this? I think all of us attach. Sure. Of course, I need more self-compassion. Of course, I need to not necessarily go easy on myself, but understand that I'm human just like everyone else, but we should ourselves to death.
Right. Well, exactly. That's the difference with self-compassion. So oftentimes we think that, you know, we're supposed to be a certain way. Self-compassion is unconditionally accepting, just like a parent. You know, if you're a parent, you unconditionally love and accept your child, right? We know that, sometimes you need to use some tough love with your kids. You need to say, hey, you need to make a change. You know, it's not compassionate to your kid to say, yeah, don't bother going to school, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Eat all the sugar you want.
Yeah, sure.
That's not compassionate. But at the same time, the bottom line is at least we try as much as we can to love our kids unconditionally. And it's the same with ourselves, right? So it's not really I should do this in order to be worthy of love. It's like, I already am worthy of love kind of by virtue of being a human being. And yet I want to be healthy. I want to be well. I want to alleviate my suffering. So what do I need right now? How can I help myself? That's really the attitude that makes self-compassion so beneficial.
So, you know, with all these benefits, then what holds people back from practicing self-compassion?
Well, there are two main reasons. So most people are much more compassionate and supportive to the good friends, for instance, than they are to themselves. One reason is just our culture doesn't really tell us it's a good thing to be self-compassionate. Right, our culture thinks it's going to make us unmotivated, or they confuse it with self-pity. Mm. So by the way, the difference between self-pity and self-compassion is self-pity is woe is me, it's very self-focused. Compassion by its nature is actually connected. The word compassion, passion means suffer, con means with. It's a sense of we're all doing the best we can, we're all human beings, none of us is perfect. So, you know, this is hard for all of us. This is my particular form of struggle. So it's not self-pity. It doesn't undermine your motivation. It doesn't make you self-indulgent. It's not selfish. People think maybe I should be giving all my compassion to others as if I've got like 5 units of compassion. And
right.
If I give 3 to me, I only have 2 left over.
Oh, shoot, I'm out. Yeah.
And what we know from the research is actually the more compassion and emotional support you give yourself, the more you have to give to others. But our culture doesn't tell us that. Mm. And then the second reason is actually just our physiology. You know, if I fail or make a mistake, I feel really threatened. I feel really frightened. Mm. If you as my friend make a mistake, you know, I care about it, but I'm not so immediately frightened or freaked out. And so when we're really frightened, we go into fight or flight mode and we turn that inward and we beat ourselves up, hoping that, you know, it's going to help us control the situation and control ourselves and be safe. So some of this is just our natural physiological reaction to fear and threat.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kristen Neff about practicing self-compassion. We've defined what it is, certainly the need for it, the roadblocks that would stand in the way of why we wouldn't do it. I'm ready. I want to practice self-compassion. give me something I can do today. I'm not very good at this. We talk about it as a muscle. So my muscle's itty bitty, and I need to learn to be able to flex and grow that muscle. So what can I do?
Right. So the good news is it's not rocket science, because you actually already know how to be compassionate. At least I assume you do.
Oh, yeah.
I assume you've had people come to you, you know, a good friend or family member who's distressed. We know how to be supportive. We know how to be encouraging. We know how to be accepting toward others. And so really the simple thing is giving yourself permission to speak to yourself that way, right? So if you're having a hard time, let's say you're struggling with a health issue, something like that. You might imagine, well, what if I had a really close friend who is struggling with the exact same health issue? What would I naturally say to them? You know, because again, you've already learned how to be supportive. And then you just try saying it to yourself. And I'll admit it, it's going to feel weird at first. We aren't used to it. I mean, we are used to talking to ourselves really meanly. We don't even think about that.
That's that part down. I don't need help there.
Yeah, somehow that's really easy.
That's right. So it just needs a little practice, and just expect it to feel a little awkward. But over time, you start to feel the benefits of it, because, you know, we don't even think about it. So you say things that are supportive. And again, it doesn't mean you like gloss over problems. It might be some tough love, but it's supportive. It's kind. Another thing you can do, which is actually very simple, mm-hmm. is because some of this is rooted in our physiology, if you use some sort of comforting or supportive touch, like maybe your hand on your stomach or your heart or your face, our bodies respond instinctually to warm touch as a signal of care. And again, you may want to do this in private because it looks a little funny to do it in public.
Excuse me, everyone. I'll be right back. Right.
You know, if you try it out, it's amazing that your body doesn't really know the difference. So you can put your hand on your heart or your face or your stomach, and your body starts to calm down. And then you layer in, you know, well, what would I say to a good friend in this situation? And you try it out for yourself, and it makes an almost immediate difference. You don't have to practice for 10 years to see the benefit, mm-hmm. right? It's actually much quicker than that. And so, again, if that little voice says, well, I don't believe this, in a way, you don't even have to believe it. And it's not positive affirmation. It's not saying, oh, you're great. Everything's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Because actually, it may not be. But you're saying, I'm here for you. I support you. What can I do to help? I care about you, right? And then when you do that over time, you start to get the benefits of feeling your own support.
As I hear you talk, I brings back ideas and memories of times that my children, that I have comforted them as a mother. And it's kind of that nurturing of, okay, you know, even just putting your hand on their shoulder or holding their hand and physically comforting them, looking them in the eye and saying, okay, well, what do you need now? You know, what can we do right now? What is exactly within our control? What is not? And kind of talking to yourself as like that, it seems to me that's what you're saying, that is a way
exactly
to practice.
That's exactly what I'm saying, because you're tapping into the same system. Hmm. And by the way, for those parents who are listening, what we know is that if you model self-compassion out loud, right, other people pick up on it. So if you want to help your children to be more self-compassionate, a really great way you can do that is, you know, when you drop the glass and shatter it, instead mm-hmm. of saying, oh, I'm such an idiot, model self-compassion, model the supportive tone of voice. Well, it's human. Everyone does it. You know, okay, what do I need to do right now? Then that's a really good way to teach your children how to be more self-compassionate, leading by example. And of course, you know, we don't want our children to beat themselves up mercilessly. Mm-hmm. We want them to support themselves. And the best way we can do that is by being self-compassionate. And they'll pick up on it in our word, in our deed, in our facial expressions toward ourselves. So it doesn't just help you, it also helps other people.
Saying those things out loud certainly models the behavior for a spouse, for our children, and those things. Are there benefits if we are by ourselves saying those things out loud?
Oh right. So we don't have the research to say if it matters whether or not you say it out loud or just internally.
Okay.
I think it's just whatever feels more comfortable to you.
I like the idea of being like, well, everyone's human, just yelling it if I do something, you know.
You know, if it works, there is
extreme self-compassion, yes.
There's a little research that shows if you gaze in the mirror, kind of with a compassionate gaze, kind of a kind gaze, that does help. So you can do it in front of a mirror, and you can certainly say it out loud if it feels like it helps. But again, really, everyone just needs to try it out. You don't have to take my word for it. You can also read about 3,000 research studies. Most of them are on my website. So it's not a woo-woo idea. I mean, there's a lot of empirical support for this.
Well, and I appreciate, you bringing that to the table here.
Well, yeah, because our culture doesn't support it, it really helps if you say, hey, listen, the research demonstrates it's not going to undermine your motivation. It's not going right. to make you selfish. Here's the research studies that show that. Yeah.
For a lot of people right now, this is a very intense time. And so I want to just ask you about when things get really intense, when mm-hmm. it is life and death, when it is something to worry about, what ideas do you have for showing up for yourself and providing yourself in a little bit more self-compassion when it is a crisis situation.
Well, absolutely. And by the way, the research shows in a crisis, you want self-compassion. It's like when you go into battle, do you want an enemy inside your head cutting you down? Mm-hmm. Or do you want an ally saying, I've got your back, I'm here for you? Right. And so ways you could do it is, first of all, you may just take a little pause. It doesn't mean you've got to like sit on a meditation cushion for 20 minutes. You can just take a little pause and say, this is really hard right now. You know, well, mm-hmm. it's not just me. This is part of being human. How can I care for myself in the moment? And that might take a minute. Right. You can put your hand on your heart or your hand on your stomach, just in the midst of the really difficult situation. You can actually sit down if you want a longer practice. For instance, website selfcompassion.org. I've got a lot of, you know, tapes you can play for about 20 minutes to guide you through a practice. So there's a lot you can do, but, you know, and these times are just, they're so stressful for everyone. I mean, if it's not one thing, it's another, right? Yeah. Stress just keeps coming. And the more we can support ourselves through the midst of the stress, really, the more resources we'll have to support our children, our friends, other people, you know, and to turn a lot of our angst into something constructive as opposed to destructive.
I love that, as you mentioned, that one of the resources that's available, because for some people, they are better at this than others. They have little bit of muscle, and other people, you know, either have never practiced this or it is a poorly practiced thing, but to have these narrated, these sort of practices that people can get from selfcompassion.org can, in addition to the research that you guys have provided, really be able to help people start building this muscle.
Mm-hmm. So we've developed a program. We have like 37 exercises, empirically supported exercises to help. So it's something you can practice. It's not just a good idea. You know, we've developed the technology, the pedagogy of how to teach self-compassion. So it's all available now.
So relating this then to working out, I could essentially get self-compassionately just shredded. Is that
right? Yeah.
With these, just like
your core.
Yeah, I could just. I would. I could be a physical model, a specimen of self-compassion. Selfcompassion.org is the website. We've been visiting with Kristen Neff, who is a pioneer in self-compassion research, and has co-developed that training program, the Mindful Self-Compassion. Find it, selfcompassion.org.
Next up in 2 minutes, we're going to tell you if you might actually be working out too much.
You are listening to The Lisa Show. With the holidays upon us, so are all of the treats and goodies that come with it. Last night when I got home, a delicious plate of fudge on my porch, and I had two thoughts. One, how fast can I eat this? And two, I wonder where this came from. And it was actually in that order. It's easy to blow all of our fitness progress telling ourselves that, you know, with that New Year's resolution, we'll get back on track. Well, maybe there's a better approach to our health. Today, we're talking with Annika Christensen, a certified personal trainer and fitness instructor. Her philosophy is that balance and moderation are the keys to building and maintaining a healthy relationship with exercise and food. Good morning, Annika.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, this idea of moderation, I'm not familiar, so you may have to break it down really basic for me.
Really basic. Well, I think most people aren't familiar with it. We try and say we are, but really we have this total up and down where we are super good and then we're super bad, and we attach morality to food and we label our days and our foods as good and bad. Mm-hmm. And that's just going to set us up for failure.
and I love the self-divulging things where it's like, I've been so bad today. That I love that as part of the conversation as well.
Totally. Yeah, we do that all the time.
So moderation, what then is it? I mean, I jokingly asked you, but maybe I do need to know exactly what it is.
Well, I think moderation would be trying to take away the labels, take away the good and the bad,
and think of exercise and food as fuel for our bodies. And so when I'm training with clients and teaching them, we're talking more about, like, we are BMWs. We need to fuel our bodies with the good stuff, with the premium, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we're not our little old Corollas anymore. And so being able to look at food in a holistic approach and saying, like, okay, there's foods that fuel me more, and there's foods that are more fun. Like, I hope you ate some fudge last night, because that sounded good.
Bless you, Annika, to think I ate just some fudge last night. I might have eaten the whole plate. I'm not going to tell you, because it sounds like it's not moderation. But I also am not going to say I was so bad last night, because I've learned that so far.
Yeah, and that's what we typically do, is we say, oh, I've been bad. And then that attaches shame to the food or to the habit. And the eating of the fudge isn't what's going to, like, cause us to totally derail. It's then the shame about it, and then feeling like, oh my goodness, that was awful, and now I need to, like, either do something to fix it, or I need to go deeper into this hole. That's where the scary mindset comes in. So instead of putting shame to it, instead you can say, like, oh, you know what? I clearly ate that whole thing, and it was delicious, and I loved it. And now I don't feel great, and I kind of want to fuel instead of have so much fun with my foods today.
it's an interesting approach to all this, because it shows me that so many of these things are deeper rooted than just that split second choice that I make to grab one thing that would better fuel my body than the other.
Totally. It's definitely every single person. If you feel like food, or if anyone feels like, oh, I just have this struggle with food, it's because every single person does. Like, we have a relationship with food, just like we have a relationship with our siblings who we sometimes fight with and don't get along with, or with our in-laws, or all these different relationships in our life. Food and fitness is another one of those. And so every single person you look at, whether they seem like they have it all together or not, has to work on that relationship, and has either come to a point where they've made peace with it, or they're still working towards it.
The perspective that our food is our fuel, I like that. The idea to not shame ourselves for when we may have struggled a little bit more, I like that as well. Are there other pieces to this moderation that will help us sort of reframe how we look at what we eat?
Totally. I mean, there's so many things. I am really passionate about this topic. But I think fitness goes hand in hand with food. What you can't outrun a bad diet, darn it. I wish we could, but it's really that fitness component helps us get in the right mindset, and it can help increase our metabolism that then allows us to burn our fuel more effectively. So I think the fitness component, some people would like to say, like, oh, I'll just sit and I'll just restrict and then not eat a lot, and then that'll help me lose weight. It's totally twisted. And actually, most of my weight loss clients who I work with are under eating and under fueling the good stuff. And then they're starving by the end of the day, and then we make crazy choices, you know? And so having consistency with both fitness and then also eating, every 2 to 3 hours, you're allowed to eat again. And you never have to get so starving that you reach for anything. And you never have to feel so full that you're uncomfortable.
So the idea of several mini meals, for those that maybe have never heard of that, because I think fundamentally we go, oh, it's breakfast, lunch, dinner. That's how it goes. One is in the first part of the morning when I wake up. Middle of the day, I eat my lunch, and then I eat dinner, watch some TV, and go to bed. These mini or smaller meals, what do they look like?
Yeah, well, all of this is so dependent on the person. But I feel like generally most people get hungry in between these, you know, 6 hour stretches from meal to meal. And so thinking of having breakfast like a king, lunch as a prince, and dinner as a pauper. What I mean by that is, when you're, think about what you're fueling for. So when we wake up, we have breakfast, we're fueling our bodies, we have a long day ahead of us. So I would go with something with lots of protein and carbs and some fats to get us going for a big meal, you know, like a fueling, energizing meal. And then know that in 2 more hours, you can grab a snack and you're allowed to have more food 2 hours later. There's not this scarcity mentality. And doing this and then having lunch the same, a good, healthy, like healthy meaning big size lunch, you know, to fuel our bodies. Mm-hmm. And then 2 hours later, you can have a snack. And then dinner, what are we fueling for? Not very long. Yeah. We're going to eat dinner, do a little bit of work, and then hopefully go to bed. Mm-hmm. So our dinners actually can be a lot smaller. And eating this way with these mini meals will keep our metabolism from, and our sugar, our blood sugar from just like plummeting, where we have those total dips in energy and then sugar spikes and things like that. It'll kind of keep us more leveled throughout the day.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Annika Christensen, who is a certified personal trainer and fitness instructor. We've talked a lot about just sort of eating and dieting or fueling principles in general. I want to turn part of our conversation to, I queued this up talking about the fudge that showed up on my porch. And man, I'll tell you what, that first week of December until the new year, so often, and I know I'm not alone in this, is, I'll get back on the wagon, you know, the first of the year. I'll kind of wave these last few weeks of the year and I'll really get started again. I'll dedicate myself in the new year, but We can do a lot of detriment in these 3-4 weeks of the holidays in December.
We can. Well, and what I would say for people who are like really big on, oh, I'm going to wait till January 1st, is I would say, and how has that worked in the past? Has it? Maybe it has. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like maybe you're one of those highly motivated goal setter people where January 1st is just your time to shine. But for most of us, that's not how it works, mm-hmm. unfortunately. And usually we're setting ourselves into shame and bad habits in these next couple weeks where we think we can just overindulge in everything. And then January 1st comes and we feel even worse mm-hmm. about ourselves. Mm-hmm.
And it's that much harder.
December 1st.
Yeah, and it's that much harder because we've just had the last couple weeks of essentially eating whatever we would like. How do you do this? Is this something that you struggle with?
So I'm currently pregnant, so I currently eat pretzels all day, uh-huh. so I feel a little bit, I feel a little funny, but as I'm, like, what I do is what I coach my clients on is please eat the treats, please, and you know what's going to happen, like, mm-hmm. We're rooted in tradition, so we know that Christmas Eve there's going to be, you know, a great dessert, and maybe Christmas morning there's cinnamon rolls. I want you to enjoy that, and you should enjoy that, mm-hmm. and don't feel bad about it, because the shame is what then causes us to go for numbers 3 and 4 and 5 and way beyond our hunger and fullness cues. So what I would say is try and get in, find a buddy, find a sibling if you're home, or find a friend and go out and get some exercise during the holidays, because it's just going to start your day off on a better note. Mm-hmm. And then drink water like it's nobody's business, because so often we think we're hungry when we're thirsty. The water, yeah. And so waking up, like the very first thing I do with my kids and myself is I make everyone drink water. And they know it now. Yeah. They know that they just wake up and drink water, because that gets your metabolism going and it cues your body to start cleaning out and doing good things. So try and get in a little bit of movement, drink a ton of water, and then honor your hunger and fullness honestly during the holidays.
In my mind's eye, I see this sweet moment where you, Annika, are waking up your child and you're like, good morning, sweetheart. Here's a big glass of water. And they're like, wait, I just woke up. All right, Mom, if I drink this water, will you leave me alone?
Please, sure.
Yeah, please.
Please let me sleep.
I drank my water. Just 5 more minutes, please.
So I wish it's the other way. I'm saying, just give me 5 more minutes. Go back to bed.
Yeah. So we have talked sort of about this exercise component of this, but there are a lot of people who will likely be getting some sort of fitness equipment or fitness wear for Christmas and are sort of recommitting themselves to taking better care of themselves. Maybe not a New Year's resolution, right? Maybe they know better than to do that, but have just said, you know what? this COVID-19, these 19 pounds are a real thing. I need to shed them. Yeah. I need to take better care of myself. What sort of mindset practices do you have or can you share with us as we look to get in better shape?
Totally. One of the biggest shifts that I think helps people out is exercising because we love our bodies, not because we're mad at our bodies or we hate our bodies. And when you think of it, that it seems silly to like, oh, if I just think differently, mm-hmm. but then it makes the fitness part feel like you're doing something good for yourself instead of punishing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're coming from a place of like punishment, it's going to be real hard to motivate ourselves day after day. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
So I like that mindset shift. And then also, you go. What were we going to say?
I just was going to say that it sometimes for me becomes such a mind, like the workout is a mind thing. It's less my body. My body is willing to do this. It's the mind getting into it is the most difficult
thing. Getting there is half the battle. Mm-hmm. Yesterday at my 5:30 a.m. class, we had one person come. And it's usually a packed class. So it's cold and it's dark and it's holidays and I get it. It's hard. It's hard to get there. But once you get there, say that you'll give yourself 10 minutes. Say, I'll just work out for 10 minutes and see how that feels.
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, after 10 minutes, you're like, oh, you know what? This does feel good. And then find something that you love. The very best form of exercise is something you'll do.
Mm.
It really doesn't. I mean, we can make it as basic as that. You know what I mean? Like, yes, ideally it's 2 to 3 days a week strength training and 2 to 3 days a week of cardio. But if that's not going to happen,
mm-hmm.
just find something that you love. Whether there's so many group fitness classes online right now, you can literally be in your underwear doing it at your house, surrounded by whoever.
Uh-huh.
So it's never been easier to find something you love.
Annika, how many times a week or a month would you say as a personal trainer and fitness instructor do you get people who come up and ask you, you know, Annika, I've heard about this new diet, this new way of this, and what do you think about that, like these sort of extreme things? What is it about those things that just make them unsuccessful?
Totally. So many clients are like, oh, well, I'm doing this. And then I usually ask, and how is your energy level? Mm-hmm. How are you feeling mm-hmm. on keto? Or how do you feel on Atkins? And then once they connect it, because most people aren't actually thinking through that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, actually, I have no energy because I haven't had a carb in a week and I'm going crazy. I would totally say there is place in every weight loss plan or every just maintaining diet, a healthy diet, balanced mm-hmm. diet for carbs, proteins, and fats. And we need all of those. These crazy extremes are only going to lead us. They might work. They might work for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They might work for a month. And maybe even for 6 months, but then all of a sudden we're here for the lifestyle. You know what I mean? And as we're getting older, we're like fighting against ourselves, which is so weird, but our bodies are deteriorating and we got to keep it up. So we need to make sure that we're increasing our metabolism and cutting out carbs and doing extreme things like that is only going to lower our metabolism, which then burns less calories.
People kind of pull you aside and say, hey, I've got this thing. And you're like, diet and exercise. And they're like, no, you haven't even heard this thing yet. And you're like, no, I'm telling you, diet and exercise, what you put in and how much you
totally.
Exercise. That's the answer. Stop asking the questions. Now, I do have one more question before I let you go.
Yeah.
You've been a personal trainer. You said you're very passionate about it. It can be difficult for many. In fact, I'm sure you've had clients who have struggled at first or struggled for a while. What is it that makes you so passionate about working in this space?
We've all had to come to our own space of finding a love of fitness and food and balance. And so personally, I have too. And I've been in fitness my whole life. And then I've had times in my life where I'm more extreme on the health scale
mm-hmm.
and then where I'm more relaxed. And I've found this balance that's really worked. And so it's so fun to be able to share it with other people and like see the liberation.
Mm.
You can almost see it on their faces when they're like, oh my gosh.
like, I had a piece of pizza and I'm not in trouble. Yeah. No one's getting mad at me, you know, like, it's okay. There's just different types of fuel. And it's really, really awesome and heartwarming to, like, see these clients just realize that they can have a healthy, like, liberated relationship with themselves.
Mm, I love that. One last thing before you go. I heard about this new diet, Annika, where if I don't eat and I exercise a lot, I'll drop weight really quick. Can you give me any? I'm teasing, of course. Annika Christensen,
you're totally right. That's gonna happen.
Yeah.
And then you're gonna feel terrible.
Oh,
so please don't do that.
Okay. I will not do that. Annika Christensen, a certified personal trainer and fitness instructor who believes balance is the key to building and maintaining a healthy relationship with exercise and food. You can get more health and fitness inspiration by following her on Instagram at Annika_James. Now, if you have any guest suggestions, topic suggestions, things you would like us to discuss as we roll out of 2020 and into 2021, we would love to hear from them or hear from you about them. The Lisa Show at BYU.edu is the email address, and you can put those in the subject line. That's topic suggestion or guest suggestion or, you know, hey, Richie, hey, Lisa, I've never heard you guys talk about this from your personal experience. We'd love to hear you talk about that. You can do that as well. The email address, one more time, is thelisashow@BYU.edu.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on our BYU Radio app, which I hope that you have downloaded. You can listen on demand there. You can also find us on SiriusXM channel 143.
Find The Lisa Show wherever you get podcasts. Click subscribe so you do not miss a single moment of the show.
Now, on tomorrow's show, we're going to tell you how to make sure you never get food poisoning again, ever.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show.